Greetings, everybody. Welcome back to the Morning Lineup podcast for Tuesday, January 23rd. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz, and we've got a jam-packed program for you today. Joe Posnanski will join us to talk about the 2018 National Baseball Hall of Fame class that will be announced Wednesday night on MLB Network. And Mike Petriello will look at what the future might hold for prominent free agent J.D. Martinez. But first and foremost, let's bring in my MLB.com cohort, Richard Justice. And Richard, I don't know if you can tell, but right off the bat, I got to apologize for what's left of my voice here. I don't know if I'm coming off the bubonic plague or what, but you might have
Eagles
to carry
fan,
me.
Huh?
You got those pristine pipes. You might have to carry this today.
You sound like a great Eagles fan. You're just ready to go.
Sound like Mike Trout after wearing the dog mask or whatever he was wearing at the Eagles game. Yeah, the Eagles roll to the Super Bowl where, I don't know, I'm assuming they'll get rolled by the Patriots because that's what happens. But let's talk a little baseball. Obviously, still not much developing on the free agent market, but we do want to talk about the top pitcher out there, of course. That's Yu Darvish. And Richard, I was thinking that we've discussed this guy so much, he probably needs his own segment. And I was thinking, like, what song would be the good lead-in for Yu Darvish segment if we had the territorial rights, that is? I was thinking Burning for You by Blue Oyster Cult. You Can't Always Get What You Want by the Rolling Stones.
There you go.
Talking About You by Chuck Berry.
There you go.
Got My Mind Set on You by George Harrison, or Who's Loving You by the Jackson 5. Which one of those is your pick?
I would go with the Jackson 5 always. And I think Yu's liking this. I really do. And I think other players, you know, Posnos, Eric Hosmer, and Mike Moustakas, I think those guys want some certainty. But Yu seems to just be riding the wave, taunting us on Twitter, teasing us. And my feeling still is he would like to get back to the Texas Rangers. He makes his home there. But unless John Daniels is playing a great game of poker, he does not intend to bring him back. And so I think we've always thought, like, Brewers, Twins, you know, maybe the Yankees jump in at the end if you could get a really backloaded contract. But I think the longer we go into this, that Yu's going to get more money and more years than any other player out there. That could be wrong because Hosmer is obviously a big target out there and may get 6 or 7 years. But we'll see. Ultimately, though, if I still had a nickel to place on it, I would say he ends up with the Texas Rangers, even though it's not even clear that they have made him an offer or intend to make him an offer.
Well, we know he's comfortable there, and that plays a big role for Yu Darvish's transition to the United States. You know, that was a huge element for him going to Texas and the relationships he built there. But obviously, money talks. There was a report earlier this week. Well, first of all, ESPN's Jerry Krasnick reported there was a 5-year offer to Darvish. Not clear what team that is, but we do know also there are reports on Monday that the Brewers have made an offer to Darvish. And coming off a surprise 2017 season where basically they finished a pitcher short of the postseason. You know, they pushed the Cubs all year in the NL Central, surprisingly so. They got Jimmy Nelson on the shelf after shoulder surgery. They got really no major long-term entanglements outside the Ryan Braun contract, Richard. So Darvish makes a lot of sense for that club in theory. I think all along there's kind of been this curiosity as to whether, you know, they'd actually go out and make a splurge like that.
Yeah, I didn't think they were going to make a trade because they have too much invested in that farm system, and it's really good. And you're right. I mean, Jimmy Nelson thinks he's way ahead of schedule, could be back in the first half of the season. Anderson, Davies, Brent Suter took a step forward. They've got Gallardo back. My question for you, Castro, is this. Okay, they sign Yu Darvish. Where are they in the pecking order in the NL Central? Does this move them back in front of the Cardinals have made up ground on the Cubs. Does this move the Brewers back in front of the Cardinals, or are they still a third-place team?
It could move them ahead of the Cardinals. I mean, one thing I like about the Brewers and Cardinals is kind of that next line of defense. For the Cardinals, you know, their pitching staff, I think the back end of their pitching staff is really starting to come together with some nice young arms. I think the Brewers, they got depth in a lot of places, arms and bats, primarily bats. So I think maybe the regression that's kind of predicted for the Brewers from last year is maybe a little overstated because of the depth they do have, and whether that be guys who actually impact them this year or maybe even impact them in the trade market mid-year. I just think it's a dangerous team when you have you know, those young assets on top of. I think they played over their skis a little bit in 2017. Don't get me wrong. So I just don't know if the regression will be, you know, that steep if they, especially if they go out and get a big arm like Darvish. So
yeah. Yeah, and they have young pitching too. I mean, Luis Ortiz and Brandon Wood debuted last year. I don't think Corbin Burns is that far away. I'm telling you, David Stearns has done a terrific job there rebuilding that organization, and that's why they were going to make a trade. That as they look 2 years down the road, 3 years down the road, they really like where they are as an organization, and Darvish's would be a long-term investment.
All right, I don't want to alarm anybody, but we did actually have another free agent signing on Monday. Austin Jackson agrees to terms with the San Francisco Giants, a 2-year, $6 million guarantee, according to John Heyman, MLB Network Insider and FanRag Sports. So there it is, Richard. The Giants last week, of course, acquired Andrew McCutchen. He'll play right field for them. They acquired Evan Longoria earlier in the season to play third base, and now they've got their center fielder, a defensively sound one at that, and Austin Jackson. It kind of fits with this mold of, this team looks especially good if the year is 2012, 2013 with some of the names they've added. But Austin Jackson had a really solid season with the Indians last year. He's had knee injuries in the past, but he kind of proved himself over that and made that incredible catch over the wall in Fenway Park, one of the great catches of the year, but really a productive bat for them.
Yeah, and it fills up. It's a big center field. They need a guy to go play out there. Well, they want McCutchen to play right field. And you know what they did? Like, I guess my prediction of them going out and signing Lorenzo Cain and J.D. Martinez and having a $225 million payroll actually is not going to come through. They go out and they get Evan Longoria, Andrew McCutchen, and Jackson. They fill three holes there, and they were able to get out from under Matt Moore's contract. They're under the luxury tax threshold to reset that. And, you and I have talked about this before. Some of they're counting on – it's an old team. Everybody's going to be 30. And Hunter Pence is going to be 35 early in the season. Brandon Belt's going to be 30. I mean, it's not a young team, so you do have the risk of injury. But Fangraphs has them penciled in for a 21-game improvement and now finishing ahead of both the Diamondbacks and Rockies. And it speaks well of management that you could fill your holes and still manage your payroll pretty smartly. None of the real bombshell free agent moves, we'll see. I still look at the back of the rotation. I look at the age of the roster and all that and say, I'm not sure I'm buying in. I'm not buying in them finishing ahead of the Dodgers, but I certainly could see the Giants and the Cardinals playing in the NL wildcard game.
Well, as you said, Richard, J.D. Martinez to the Giants won't be happening this offseason like some of us may have thought earlier in the winter. But obviously, J.D. Martinez to the Red Sox is still a possibility. The Boston Herald reported in recent days that the Red Sox made Martinez an offer of 5 years and $125 million. He's also said by MLB Network insider John Heyman to be looking for 6 years and $30 million a year. So that's $180 million. So just, just a $55 million gap and 1 year gap between what they're offering and what he's seeking. But it's a lot of money for a 30-year-old slugger in this marketplace, anything over $100 million. So on that note, let's bring in Mike Petriello, MLB.com analyst. And Mike, I know you're itching to tell us just what a great investment a bat-only 30-something is, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's pretty clear. And you're right. When I saw the numbers, 5 years and $125 million, my first thought was $25 million a year sounds about right, but there's no way he was going to accept only $5 million or 5 years. And obviously he hasn't so far. But you bring up a great point. Like, he's an elite hitter, obviously. He's not much of an outfielder defensively, and he's already 30 years old. So if we're trying to figure out how many years are appropriate going into the future, I thought maybe an interesting way to do it would be to go find previous versions of J.D. Martinez. And by that, I mean very similar players from the last 40 years, very good hitters, below average outfielders, who were basically finishing off their 20s on a high note, and see what happened to them as they got into their 30s. And I'm actually kind of happy with the results, because we seriously remembered some guys, as I emailed to you earlier.
Yeah, that was I asked Mike for a copy of the article to look at before we record this, and that's what he said. Let's play Remember Some Guys. And it is. It's an eclectic list you came up with. 21 names based on your inputs. And this will be up on MLB.com if you want to check out Mike's piece. But basically, the offensive parameters you put in there, negative defensive value according to Fangraphs, slugging percentage over 500, basically to find just the true power bats. And came up with 21 names. Let's just rattle them off, Mike. Bobby Abreu, Albert Bell, Lance Berkman, Adam Dunn, Cliff Floyd, Kirk Gibson, Juan Gonzalez, Sean Green, Pedro Guerrero, Vladimir Guerrero, Josh Hamilton, Matt Holliday, Kevin Mitchell, Dale Murphy, Maglio Ordóñez, Dave Parker, Kirby Puckett, Manny Ramirez, Gary Sheffield, Danny Tartable, and Bernie Williams. That's a wide range of outcomes past, you know, into the age 30 plus seasons, which of course JD Martinez is entering his age 30 season. So where do things kind of trend from here? It seems like obviously the first year of the deal, generally the first year of the 30s, age 30 season, tended to be pretty good for this group, but and then obviously a wide range of outcomes from there.
Yeah, I mean, these are impressive names, as you say, and I think the biggest reason for that is that I very specifically chose four guys who had very good seasons. You know, like we said, one of the biggest requirements was that they had to have a weighted runs created plus of over 135, 135, where 100 is league average, right? So these are guys who had to have, for a span of 3 years, been 35 points better than average. And I didn't want like the Tony Gwynn types, so I also included slugging percentage over 500. So, of course, these were guys coming off three very, very good seasons. And as you would expect, they were also very good the next season. For age 30, these guys averaged almost 550 plate appearances and still 32 points above league average. 14 of these 21 guys hit at least 20 homers that season. Pretty much everyone who was healthy had a pretty good season, as you'd expect. You go on to age 31, pretty much the exact same thing. This is where Kirk Gibson won the National League MVP award. The group averaged 27 home runs. They averaged almost four wins above replacement, where two wins is a league average season. The only exception here is that Adam Dunn had that atrocious first year with the White Sox where he hit .159, but a little bit of an outlier. So for the first 2 years, if you're starting off at such a high level as he's been, you're going to expect two really good seasons. The third year, age 32, pretty much the same. You know, another solid season, not quite as great. You've got a bunch of guys like Puckett and Berkman who finished in the top five in the MVP balloting. And for the most part, everyone stayed healthy. I mean, this is the most important part. Of these 20-something guys, only three guys didn't play 100 games at age 32. So for the first 3 years for all these similar guys, things are going great. It's age 33 where things start to diverge a little bit. You know, you have some of these guys having fantastic seasons. This is the year Maglio Ordóñez blew up and had an 8-win season. And Sheffield and Holiday and Abreu and Bernie Williams all had really good seasons. But there are 20 guys from the original list who were playing at age 33, and half of them had terrible years. And what that really means is that they started hitting good but not great, and the defense was a mess. You know, Parker and Dunn and Bell, guys who were never really great defenders in the first place, were pretty much unplayable. So the first 3 years looked great. Age 33, it starts to split off between what direction you're going to go. And age 34, it's kind of more of the same. You know, Bell was done. Tartable was done. Some of these guys just didn't really play that more because they got injured. But, you know, Matt Holiday, for example, was above average for every year that deal with the Cardinals. You know, at 34, Sheffield was a top three in the MVP. Parker was a top three in the MVP. And it's the same thing at 35. A lot of these guys were done, but you also had some great seasons from Berkman, from Sheffield. But, you know, you get to this point, we started out with 21 guys, 22 guys, and now we're talking about like three or four who are still productive at age 35. So my takeaway from all of this is that looking at these comparable players from the last 40 years, I would feel extremely confident with health. Obviously, that's the huge thing with health. But for the first 3 years, he's going to be fantastic. And the fourth year, you know, good. And then the fifth year, maybe average. And I'd be really worried beyond that because this is not a guy who is going to, you know, have defense as a carrying card. He's probably going to be DH sooner than later.
And Mike, let me ask you, facts matter in this offseason more than any other. So if you're JD Martinez, and you know that teams are looking at the data on this, why do you turn down 5 years?
Well, I mean, I think that's a great question. You're hoping that some team gets desperate as the as spring training approaches and said, this is a bat I really need to have. I think everybody thinks it's going to be the Red Sox. I think it's also because Scott Boris is not the type to go lightly into the night. You know, He's going to ask for what he's going to ask for. And I think each side is going to wait for the other side to blink. It feels to me if the offer is 5 for $125, there is room for an agreement here, right? You start with that and maybe there's like a 6-year vesting option for 25 more or something like that. I cannot imagine anyone's giving him 7 guaranteed years.
Now, if you're the Red Sox, how are you selling this? We're going to get a great player for 3 years. We're going to win a World Series. That's going to affect tickets, sponsorships, the whole thing, TV revenues. And, you know, we may make a bad investment for the last 2 years, but we're in this to win a championship and to play with the Yankees. Is that how you sell it from offering what you know the data says the last 2 years is not going to be a good deal for you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not even sure that J.D. Martinez is going to be the one selling tickets. You know, it's weird for the Red Sox.
That's a good point.
Without any question, the Red Sox need some power, right? We all know that they did not hit very many home runs last year. And I think part of that will bounce back naturally. I think Betts and Bogarts are both playing through injuries. I just think naturally those guys will be better this upcoming year. But it's also somewhat of a weird fit for them because Martinez has pretty much said he does not want to be an everyday DH. I'm sure he'll do it part-time, but he doesn't want to do it every single day. And right now the Red Sox have three really, really good outfielders in Betts and Bradley and Benintendi. I don't know that it's going to be so simple as slotting him in and then moving Betts to center and trading Bradley, however it might work out. And that might not even make the team that much better because none of those guys are the hitter that Martinez is. But when you look at the total package of defense and base running, it's a little closer than you might think. So that's still the obvious fit, but it's not the perfect fit people think it is. And at this point, if I'm other teams, if I'm, let's say, the Indians or the Twins or maybe even the Cubs, I'm jumping in and saying, listen, this guy is a perfect fit. We didn't think we'd have a shot at him, but we could certainly use him in our lineup. Now is the time to jump. I could see that happening. And if it's not, it should be.
No, I was just saying that this whole thing with JD, this market in general really just speaks to what I'm hearing from executives in general, what you yourself have studied, Mike, which is just there's a lot of ageism going on out there. There's a lot more opportunities for players under 30 years old. And, you know, it's a real difference maker in the game. You had some data on an article recently. In 2000, players aged 30 and older took 86,019 plate appearances, and they threw 17,373 and a third innings. They contributed 43.4% of all wins above replacement. That was players 30 and older in the year 2000. In the year 2017, you go from 43.4% of all wins above replacement to 32%. You go from 86,000 plate appearances to 69,000 plate appearances, 17,000 innings to 15,000 and change. So it's been a dramatic difference just in the way opportunities are doled out in this game.
Yeah, isn't that nuts, dude? You look at the players over 30, like you just said, they dropped 17,000 plate appearances and over 2,000 innings in just a span of 17 years. And let's be very honest about some of it. Young players cost less, and we have much better PED testing than we did back in the day. Certainly those things have somewhat of an impact. But I also just think we're realizing that the young players tend to stay healthier. We're much better at evaluating defense than we used to be. And young players who are generally faster tend to be better defenders. We are valuing versatility more than ever. And a lot of these younger athletic players are more willing to move around the diamond. So there's a lot of different reasons. But yeah, you're right. This is why for all the talk of the cold off season, when we get to next winter and when we get to Harper and Machado at 26 years old and a 10-year deal still only takes you up to 35, 36 years old, we're not going to be worried about the age so much because those guys are so much younger. Obviously, we have some of these guys now like Arrieta, who's already 32, and Martinez, who's already 30. You don't really want to have to commit to these guys past, say, age 35. I do think that is an enormous part of why we're seeing this, obviously, extremely cold hot stove.
All right, Mike, I don't know how does this stuff apply to softball players in their 30s? You know anything about that?
Well, I'm entering, let's see, my age 36 season, and I am much slower than I used to be and less effective, but I am a smarter hitter. I've learned that hitting the ball on the ground is a bad thing, and I did hit the first home run of my entire life two summers ago with this new approach. So in softball, slow pitchers don't have much velocity to catch up to. I think it'll be okay.
All right. Well, hopefully J.D. Martinez will age a little better than Mike Petriello in his softball league, but we'll see what the future holds, if it's in Boston or elsewhere. But Mike, thanks for your thoughts, man.
Absolutely, guys. Take care.
All right. So, Richard, really what this boils down to with J.D. Martinez and age curves and all that is just it just shows the difficulty of longevity in this game. And, you know, it's a hard thing to even have the longevity to appear on the Hall of Fame ballot, let alone to get in the Hall of Fame. So let's have a little Hall of Fame discussion here with Joe Posnanski, our friend and colleague. And Joe, obviously, Wednesday night on MLB Network, 6 p.m. Eastern time, we will have the announcement on the baseball writers ballot for the 2018 Hall of Fame class. And you have been immersed in that ballot for many weeks now. You know, writing these great analyses of all the guys who are on that ballot. And I just want to kind of start there and ask you as you kind of dig in, because you know Jason Isringhausen is not getting in the Hall of Fame. You know Orlando Hudson's not going in the Hall of Fame. But, you know, there's achievement simply in being on this ballot, and there's something to be celebrated about what were really, you know, maybe not Hall of Fame careers, but really splendid careers.
Yeah, exactly. It's every single player who is on the ballot had a career, had a real career. I mean, they had 10 years in the big leagues, and not everybody who has 10 years in the big leagues makes it onto the ballot. So, you know, for me, the last, I don't know, it feels like 12, 12 years. I've written every day about somebody on the Hall of Fame ballot, and it was a I do it every year, and it's a lot of fun. And the thing that it reminds you of is just how good the Hall of Fame is, how good you have to be a viable Hall of Fame candidate, and then obviously how good you have to be to get 75% of the vote. I mean, it's these are pretty you know, such great heights, really. I mean, when you think about, you know, a guy like you mentioned, you know, a guy like Johnny Damon or a guy like Orlando Hudson, guys who are not going to get anywhere near the support even necessary to stay on the ballot. They're really good players, really, really good players, and they're not going to. This is as close as they're going to get, is just having their names on the ballot. So I love this time of year. I love this. This is going to be a particularly interesting Hall of Fame, because I think we are going to end up with more living Hall of Fame inductees at the celebration in July than ever, or certainly than since probably the, you know, the original Hall of Fame, you know, the first few. I mean, we could have as many as 6 or 7 living ball players going into the Hall of Fame. So it's pretty exciting.
Joe, why do you think we've gone to a big hall? And by that, I mean, I think 60% of the ballots made public this year have 10 players on them. If we get 4, let's say we put 4 players in, vote in. I'm not talking Trammell and Morris.
Sure.
That will be 16 players in the last 5 elections. The previous 8 years, we put in 9. So we've gone from over 3 a year to 1 a year. I mean, from 1 a year to 3 a year. How did this happen?
Well, it's a good question. Part of it is expansion. It's just plainly expansion. I mean, you know, you've added 6 teams, you know, since the early 90s, and that's a lot of players. I mean, that's a lot more players and a lot more, you know, players who are putting up Hall of Fame numbers. I mean, let's not forget, in addition to the however many it is, 18 or however many we're going to be putting in, we are, as voters, not voting for guys who are way above the normal, what you would consider the normal Hall of Fame line, even in the 1970s and 80s. You know, it's a really interesting point. In the early 1980s, Dave Kingman hit his 400th home run, and there was sort of a little bit of a panic, because every single player who had hit 400 home runs was in the Hall of Fame. Everyone was in the Hall of Fame up to when Dave Kingman hit his 400th home run. And there was sort of this I'd call it a little mini panic among the voters, which was, you know, what are we going to do? Dave Kingman's not a Hall of Famer, but he's hit his 400th home run, and all the 400 home run guys are in the Hall of Fame. And you know, they solved that conundrum by just not voting for Dave Kingman, which was obviously not that hard to do, really. It seems kind of a silly thing when you look back on it, but that's how it used to be. And now 400 home runs, you might not even be in the discussion. I mean, you know, you look at Carlos Lee on this year's ballot is 385. He has the same numbers essentially as Orlando Cepeda, and he's not, I don't know that he'll get a single vote. I mean, it's the numbers have gone up. Obviously, we all know about the era and the time of all that. But I think expansion has been a big, big part. They're just more players putting up Hall of Fame type careers.
And Joe, I wanted to tell you that Jim Palmer finished with 268 wins. And I'm thinking, oh, that's terrible. He's not going to get in the Hall of Fame. Well, he got 93% of the vote, so my fear. But it did seem like there was a time where there were thresholds, like 400 home runs, 300 wins, whatever. And now, do you think we are smarter at evaluating players' careers, and that the voting is smarter?
It's interesting. It's interesting. The particularly interesting, because I just had kind of a similar conversation about this with Bill James. And Bill's point, and I think it's 100% right, we're smarter and we're also dumber. It's as these things go, that's how it is. We're definitely smarter in that we look at a lot more, we have a lot more to look at and a lot more to consider. I mean, you can look at the you know, complete careers of guys. You're not going to get fooled by things as you know, tangential as, you know, how many wins they had or whether or not they won a Cy Young. And we look at things a lot deeper than that. So in those ways, I think we're a lot smarter than we used to be. I think we're also, there's a little bit going on here of sort of a single-mindedness that I think is not great for the voting. In other words, people really, really get battered and bashed if they have a different opinion than what is sort of the common sense opinion, I guess. And that's not right. That's not, there should be a lot of different ways to look at the Hall of Fame. I think that's what the Hall of Fame, part of what its charm is that what the Hall of Fame means to me is not what the Hall of Fame means to you, and not what it means to Anthony, what not what it means to Mike Petriello. I mean, everybody has sort of a different view to some degree of what the Hall of Fame is. And, you know, we're going to agree on a lot more than we disagree on, but we're at a point now, and I think it's, you know, I love it because I'm in the middle of it and I love the back and forth, but we have people who are, you know, they put a lot of thought into their Hall of Fame ballot and they come up with perfectly reasonable ballots and they just get smashed because it doesn't quite match up to what the common thought is out there. And in that way, I think we have gotten dumber.
Yeah, well, Joe, just let me say I disagree completely. I think it's I like humiliating somebody.
Well, on MLB.com, we have, you know, 13 staff writers who are revealing their ballots on MLB.com. You can check that out, and I'm sure the comment section will be filled with that vitriol. That you're going to have that. And one thing I tend to see on Twitter is just if you don't use your 10 vote allotment, you get absolutely crushed. And I mean, I don't have a vote yet. I wasn't in the Baseball Writers Association for the last couple of years. They wouldn't let us in MLB.com. It's a whole other conversation. But, you know, I would use all 10 votes personally. But, you know, if people have their reasons for not doing it, I'm not – I hate to single people out here, but Carrie Muscat, our Cubs reporter, she only used 6 votes. And it wasn't because she, you know, went against the so-called PED guys. I mean, she has Bonds and Clemens on her ballot, but she only allotted those 6 spots. Some people are just small hall people. And they they're perhaps uncomfortable with the numbers that you just mentioned, Richard, the number of people who've gotten in really in recent years. So, but yeah.
And let's just say some of the Hall of Famers are small hall guys too.
Yeah.
Pause, I want to tell you the day that Mike Schmidt was inducted into the Hall of Fame. I'm sitting in the dugout in Baltimore with Frank Robinson. Tim Kirkchin's there. And there's Mike giving his speech. And Frank mutters something about, well, just let everybody in. And Tim Kirkchin, of course, his hair immediately catches on fire. And he says, Frank, he won 9 gold gloves. He hit 500 home runs. He might be the greatest third baseman that ever put a uniform on. And Frank looks at him and goes, that's exactly what I was saying. Just go ahead and let everybody in. If Frank was of the attitude like, okay, Frank Robinson, Brooks Robinson, doors locked.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm exaggerating, but I think that's why the veteran committee, one of the reasons it's gone through so many different versions, is that those guys have a very high standard, or have had.
Yeah, and to be perfectly honest about it, I don't think that current Hall of Famers should vote for the Hall of Fame, because I think there is a tendency to want to close the door behind you. I don't think that they have the best the clearest judgment when it comes to this kind of thing. I think, and some of them have amazing viewpoints on the whole. I don't know if you guys saw not that long ago, there was, you know, I mean, obviously we all know about the Joe Morgan letter and how, you know, he came out and basically, I mean, he might as well have just written, don't put Bonds and Clemens in, right? I mean, but then a couple of Hall of Famers came out for Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens, which I thought was great. And
McCovey.
McCovey was the most prominent of those. Yeah. Which I thought was great. So I'm not saying that I don't believe in uniformity. Everybody should have their own opinion. I just think they have a lot to gain by keeping the hall as small as possible in general. I mean,
you mean the financial value? Let me just point out, Frank Robinson was being sarcastic. He understood Mike Schmidt was a great player. I mean, because if he were to hear this and I didn't put that in, he would break me over his knee. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no. And I certainly wasn't talking specifically about Frank Robinson. But, you know, I just think, yes, there is a financial gain. But there's also just, look, the fewer people that are in the Hall of Fame, the more special you are if you're in it. You know, I mean, it's your country club mentality. And look, those guys are the players who are in the Hall of Fame. are obviously all-time great players. They're already in. And I don't know that I, you know, I mean, certainly value their opinions, but I don't know they should be the ones voting. And in the end, the Hall of Fame decided that for a while there that they were the ones voting, and they didn't vote anybody in year after year. They didn't vote anybody in. So, you know, but again, I, to me, one thing that I wish we would get a little bit back, everybody loves arguing about the Hall of Fame, and I think that's fine. And I think everybody has strong opinions about the Hall of Fame. And if they stopped having those strong opinions, the Baseball Hall of Fame would not be as cool and meaningful as it is. So all of those things are fine. I just think we should have a little more tolerance for different viewpoints. And look, I tend to be somewhat in the mainstream on my viewpoints. I mean, in some degree, obviously there's no mainstream on the PED thing. So you're always going to get hit from one side or the other. I tend to be, you know, I don't get hit a lot on I do get hit a lot of the PD thing like everybody else does, but I don't get hit a lot on my choices. But I also don't like it when I see other people who make, you know, their best effort. This is who I think belongs in the Hall of Fame. That's why they have a vote, and they should be able to use that vote without you saying, no, these are the only 10 people that you're supposed to vote for. That's
well, what about when a guy submits a ballot with one or two names? Does that annoy you?
It annoys me if they don't have a good reason and a good explanation for it. And I must admit, I've not been overly impressed with the explanations. But look, if somebody said, like on this ballot, this would be a great ballot. If somebody said, I'm only voting for Chipper Jones and Jim Thome, okay? Let's just say you said that. And you say, well, why are you doing that? Well, I'm not voting for any of the PED guys. Okay, well, that's fine. And to me, Thome and my line ends right there. Those are the two best guys on the ballot. That's where my line ends. I don't think anybody was as good as those two guys. Well, you could make that argument. I mean, I wouldn't, but you could make that argument. And so if somebody did that, I would say, hey, that's well established. It's well explained. It's a viable opinion, and that's fine. If somebody puts, you know, I don't want to name names, but if somebody puts Omar Vizquel and Jim Thome is the only two on the ballot,
just don't name names.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I've never heard of such a thing.
Joe, I wanted to mention that a friend of mine one year, many years ago, did not vote for Mickey Mantle. And the reason was Mickey Mantle wasn't nice to him. And that was just his reason for not voting. Dick Young, the powerful columnist, I think he was at the New York Daily News at the time, very powerful, calls him up. And he now realizes Dick Young is going to fillet him in front of a million readers. And Dick says, I just want to ask you why you didn't vote for Mickey Mantle. And the one answer he thought of was, I don't believe a guy should get in on the first ballot. Dick Young bought it. He goes, yeah, I can see that. I got that. I'm with you. And hung up. You know, the guy basically was going to be laid out. Drawn and quartered in front of a million people if he had answered anything else. But isn't that a strange thing about the you know, the first ballot, yeah, second ballot thing?
Oh, it's so nonsensical. It's ridiculous. But I will say this, your friend, that is one thing I'd say. Look, whatever your true reasons for voting or not voting for people, come up with something better, right? I mean, if your true reason for not voting someone is like, yeah, I once wanted to interview him and he was mean to me, like, yeah, you know what? Come up with something else. See if you can come up with another reason why you didn't vote.
Yeah, well, exactly. You mentioned, you know, exactly. You could maybe make an argument for just Jones and Thome, but then that same person might also be the anti-first ballot guy. You know, they're not first ballot Hall of Famer, so then he puts in nobody and then he waits a year to vote for those two. That's not a person I want to hang with, Joe. I don't want to hang with a person who's that stringent. I want to hang with you. I want to hear your ballot. Actually, I can tell you your ballot, and you tell me kind of the reason, the general. You don't have to go into every guy, but just kind of general thoughts on the ballot you submitted. Scott Rolen, Vlad Guerrero, Edgar Martinez, Larry Walker, Mike Mussina, Curt Schilling, Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens, Jim Thome, and Chipper Jones. I mean, the guy who stands out to me right off the top is Scott Rolen because he's not polling particularly well, but I think there's obviously a great argument for him as a guy who really did everything on both sides of the ball.
Yeah, you know, I just did something. By the way, I like that both sides of the ball thing. Like that's a little football-y. I like that, both sides of the ball. You know, I just turned in my for MLB.com, which will be running it. They said give me a sentence, so a paragraph. So I literally put one sentence about why I voted for each of those guys. Like just sort of like a 3-word synopsis or whatever of this. For Roland, it's the tough. He was my 10th, so I had nine that I felt like were pretty much far and ahead. The Bonds and Clemens, I always vote for. They're the two best players I've ever seen. I get it. I understand why people don't. I don't argue with them. I'm not saying they're wrong. I'm not saying I'm right. This is what I believe. I believe the Hall of Fame should have the best players in it, so I vote for them. Larry Walker has become sort of a cause of mine. I think he's one of the all-time best, most rounded players in baseball history, did everything. I feel like he is unfairly getting hurt by Colorado, which is weird considering at the time everybody thought it was such an advantage for him. And now I think it's sort of hiding what a great all-around player he was, so I vote for him. Every year, I vote for Edgar Martinez every year because he was one of the all-time great hitters in the history of the game. I vote for Schilling and Mussina. I believe both of them should have been first ballot Hall of Famers. I don't quite get why neither one of them captured the imagination. I guess neither won a Cy Young, I guess. And you know, and we've sort of have a weird feeling if you don't have 300 wins or some incredibly, you know, five Cy Young award type of thing, people tend to ignore you. But Mussina to me is a lock. He should have been in. And Schilling, in addition to his great regular season, you know, one of the all time great postseason pitchers. So those guys should both go in. So I think if I gotten everybody except for Roland, Vlad. Vlad was one. So you want to talk about Hall of Fame voting and regrets? Last year, I had this similar situation where I had nine on the ballot and I was down to my 10th. And my 10th was going to be either Vladimir Guerrero or Manny Ramirez. And I was really, really, really torn because obviously I do not strike somebody off my ballot because they were a steroid user. Even if they tested positive, they still have a chance to go to the Hall of Fame as far as I'm concerned. And Manny was a better player overall, when you include everything, than Vlad Guerrero. And I voted for Manny. And as soon as I sent it off, I regretted it. I just regretted it because Manny wasn't just a steroid user. He was a two-time drug failing guy. And he sort of made a mockery of it at a time when whatever you want to say about Bonds and Clemens and whoever else you want to point at in the 90s, they weren't embarrassing the game because nobody ever talked about it. It was not anything anybody – there was no testing. There was no – you know, did they cheat the game? Sure, you can make the great argument, but it wasn't something that was public. It wasn't a black eye for baseball until later. And then after it became a black eye for baseball, Manny really, you know, embarrassed the game. And so I still think Manny is absolutely a Hall of Fame caliber player, but I should have voted for Vlad last year, so I corrected that this year. That made nine, and then my 10th guy was Scott Rolen. And this was the first time I've done this. And Richard, I wonder if you've ever done this. It was the first time I voted strategically. There were probably five or six guys that I could have voted for that I would have felt pretty good about. But I felt like of all those people, the person who most deserved to stay on the ballot was Scott Rolen, who I think is one of the 10 best third basemen of all time. And so I voted for him. And it looks like he will stay on the ballot. So I'm glad about that. And that was why I chose him.
I have done a strategic ballot in the past. I've not voted for Bonds and Clemens because thinking, A, they're not going to get in, and B, if I don't vote for them, there was a time where I was worried that Mussina might drop off the ballot.
Yeah.
I think you and I have exactly the same votes, except I voted for Trevor Hoffman and Billy Wagner, and I like your ballot better. I agree with you. Larry Walker was a complete player. He only played 30% of his games around that at Coors Field. Absolutely a dominant player, and he hasn't gotten the respect he deserves. Scott Rolen, I mean, a story about Scott Rolen is when he was hurt one time with the Cardinals, Walt Jocketty asked him to travel with the team because of the influence he had on everybody else. And the one guy that I hope doesn't drop off is Andrew Jones. I don't know that the guy belongs in the Hall of Fame, but he belongs in the discussion for
totally
a couple
agree.
Of years.
Totally
I mean,
agree.
One of the great center fielders that has ever played the game. And I wanted to ask you how you feel about closers, because I look at it like if you're going to vote, Jason Stark wrote this, if we're going to have DHs, we got to vote for DHs. Now, that you know, Edgar's numbers are overwhelming, and Big Poppy's numbers are overwhelming. But if we're going to put Hoffman in, to me, you have to put Billy Wagner in. If you're going to put Hoffman and Wagner in, then Lee Smith should have gone in.
Yeah.
What is? But it's hard to quantify the sabermetrics and stuff that we can use as a fallback to supplement our opinions and all. They do not hold up for closers. So how do you feel about closers?
Well, this is tough. It's tough because look, I believe Trevor Hoffman is going to go in the Hall of Fame this year, and I think it's going to be great. I love Trevor Hoffman. I think he was a fantastic closer. I think he was wonderful to watch. He was a credit to the game. He's going to make the Hall of Fame better. And one of the all-time memories I have is the 98 World Series when he came out the first time, and that was the first time I'd heard the Hell's Bells. and I mean, I still get chills thinking about how awesome it was, you know. He didn't pitch well, but he was awesome coming into the game. Here's my thing, and this is where it gets to be very tough. Yes, closers are – it's a position. It is a position, and those players should be judged on that position. That said, it's a position that requires much, much less, many, many fewer innings and much less value, really, you know, at least value that you can see. I mean, they're pitching always in clutch situations, but we're talking 60 innings a year, 70 innings a year. A starter gives you 200. I mean, it's three times. So I want to be able to judge a closer. You know, and say, hey, the best closer, if a closer transcends the position, the way I think Edgar transcended the DH position, then I'm willing to put him in the Hall of Fame. Unfortunately for these guys, now Trevor's going to get in. I think Trevor Hoffman is the second best closer on this ballot. I think Wagner was actually a better pitcher. And if I had one vote, I would have given it to Wagner. Unfortunately for everybody from here on forward, there's a guy going to be on the ballot next year who is an unquestionable, no doubt, first ballot, 100% Hall of Famer, because he not only transcended the position, he was so much better than anybody else at the position, but he also was one of the greatest, if not the greatest, postseason pitcher in baseball history in Mariano Rivera. So with that in mind, if that's my standard, and maybe that is my standard, then nobody's going to come up to that standard. And so it's very, very tough, and it's all where you draw the line. But for me, the line is much, much closer to Mariano Rivera than it is. You know, I was on MLB Now today, and they asked me about Hoffman, and I said something, and somebody tweeted me or sent me an email. I can't even remember. I think it was an email saying, first of all, saying I'm a moron for not voting for Trevor Hoffman, which is fine. I mean, I get plenty of those. I'm a moron because I did not vote for the greatest closer in the history of baseball.
Who was that?
Trevor Hoffman. And he put in the next sentence, like, period, Trevor Hoffman. And I wanted to. I never do this. I never respond in a negative way to anybody. I don't think it's right. But I wanted to respond saying, thank you for putting Trevor Hoffman next, because otherwise I would have not known who you were talking about.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. On behalf of Lee Smith, I want to thank you for your kind words. You know, and as you're talking there, I'm thinking, you know, like, I didn't know Larry Walker very well, but I knew Scott Rolen well. And I think of the pain that he played with, you know. Oh, you know, the mentality of those La Russa guys. I mean, they would basically tape them up and send them out to play in pennant races and all that. And you do think about that, a guy playing with all the stress and all the aches and pains and the warrior mentality he had, and a guy that said, okay, you can get on out to the bullpen now and, you know, get your stretching in. Probably going to need you for, you know, 8 pitches in the 9th inning if you're okay about it.
Yeah, it's just a different role. And again, if you transcend your position, whatever your position is, and that's where the Hall of Fame to me comes in. And I think it's harder in some ways. If you want to get in as a closer, I think the standard should be higher. Because honestly, I mean, one thing I thought, you know, looking at this ballot, there's not a chance in the world that I would have traded Johan Santana for Trevor Hoffman or Billy Wagner. I mean, just there's no way. They wouldn't have even been close. I wouldn't have packaged both of those together and made that trade. And that's not a knock on them. That's just the role they played and the role he played. He was a better pitcher. And you know, but we obviously have disagreements on those things.
Billy Wagner threw 100 miles an hour before it was fashionable at the All-Star game in Chicago 1 year. Barry Bonds comes up to him and says, listen, if I hit 100 mile an hour fastball out of the park, I should be able to stand there and admire it. Don't you think? And a couple of weeks later, Billy strikes him out on 100 at the end of the game. And he's talking to the media after the game. And they say, Barry Bonds is on the phone. He comes back. What was it? He said, Barry said, don't get it below 100. Hey, but what it was the respect of two guys going at each other. You gave me your best. Your best today was better than my best because in that era, you know, people didn't throw Barry strikes.
We're off the target here. Yeah, Billy Wagner, by the way, and I don't know why the Billy Wagner train hasn't gotten this rolling. Yeah. Billy Wagner has the lowest whip for any pitcher, walks and hits per inning pitched, since dead ball. The lowest whip. I mean, that's.
Yeah, I mean,
that's
insane. And what's also insane is, and I'm looking at the publicly available ballots as of right now, as we record this, it's 48% of ballots, basically. And Billy Wagner's at 10.3%.
Crazy.
Trevor Hoffman's at 77.3%. I just don't know how you can vote one and not the other. It doesn't make much sense to me, that discrepancy. And another one that jumps out at me, and this is a much smaller total for Omar Vizquel, 30.5%, which is obviously not a tremendous total as it is, but Andrew Jones, 6.4%. So, you know, your value, you're putting extreme value on defense. Omar Vizquel is a Hall of Famer and not recognizing that same value in Andrew Jones. And then Billy Wagner and Trevor Hoffman. To me, if you vote one, you got to vote the other. So, a lot of
really strange. Yeah. Ron Darling made a really, really good point today, talking about that. And he was saying, because, you know, look, with Wagner and Hoffman, for instance, you could point to saves, right? Hoffman has 600 saves and Wagner has 400 and something. And you could say, well, 600 saves, it's a magic number, or whatever you want to say. But Ron Darling made a really good point. He said, you know, the big thing is that he played for one team almost his whole career. So he has a backing, like a Padres. Anytime anything good is said about Trevor Hoffman, or bad probably, the San Diego Padre fan base really rises up for it, right? They all embrace him, and it'll be a big day in San Diego when he goes into the Hall of Fame. Billy Wagner doesn't have that. Billy Wagner played for a bunch of different teams, and it's not the same thing. It's with Omar and Andrew Jones, it shouldn't be that way. There should be just as much, you know, support from Braves fans, I guess, as from Cleveland fans. But you know, I think that's a big part of the Hall of Fame that gets overlooked is if you played for one team. I think it's what's going to get Edgar Martinez over the edge is the fact that he's got, you know, a big Seattle fan base behind him.
Yeah, and that's what I love to see in this polling as of right now. Edgar Martinez at 79.8%. In his second to last year on the ballot. So he's definitely trending in the right direction. If he doesn't get in this year, you'd feel a lot better about his chances getting in his 10th and final try next year. And I mentioned Hoffman is over the 75% threshold in the polling. And again, that could be actually for Hoffman last year, the polling had him lower than his actual total turned out to be. Usually it ends up a little higher. And Tommy and Vlad Guerrero and Chipper Jones are all north of 90%. Those guys all seem pretty much locks at this point. So it's definitely going to be a big class. And then one last thing I wanted to point out, guys, is in this polling, Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens at 64%. They need to appear on 85% of the remaining ballots to be inducted. So it's not exactly likely. But I just found it interesting on the heels of the Joe Morgan letter among first-time voters, and that's 10 known votes on this polling done by Ryan Thibodeau. You can follow Not Mr. Tibbs on Twitter. He's got the updated polling, but Bonds at 90%, Clemens at 100% among first time voters. So I don't think Joe Morgan's going to be happy to hear those results.
He doesn't talk to those young whippersnappers anyway. They won't bother him. As long as he can get the old guys, he'll be all right.
Yeah, you should have tweeted him. Don't send an email, Joe. You got to tweet at him or you know, Tinder or something. I don't know.
Kids don't know the email. The kids don't do the email thing now.
All right. Well, good stuff, guys. I'm going to go try to fix my voice here. Actually, I went to get a cough drop and spilled some NyQuil that I apparently opened last night. And now it looks like a crime scene in my bathroom. So I'm going to go take care of that. But good talk on the Hall of Fame and all things baseball. And thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll talk to you soon.